had little tolerance for me, and I for him. I would not have trusted my health to his purges and tonics. Besides, what works for your kind sometimes does nothing for mine.
Is your kind so vastly different from mine? I asked after a time. He had brought us close to a topic we had seldom even mentioned.
In some ways,
he sighed. He lifted a hand to his brow.
But sometimes I surprise even myself.
He took a breath, then sighed it out, as if he had endured some pain for an instant.
I may not even be truly ill. I have been going through some changes in the past year, as you have noticed.
He ended the last in a whisper. You have grown and gathered color, I agreed softly.
That is part of it.
A smile twitched over his face, then faded.
I think I am almost an adult now.
I snorted softly. I have counted you as a man for many years, fool. I think you found your manhood before I did mine.
Did I? How droll!
He exclaimed softly, and for a moment sounded almost like himself. His eyes sagged shut.
I am going to sleep now,
he told me. I made no reply. I shouldered deeper into the blanket beside him and set my walls once more. I sank into a dreamless rest that was not cautionless sleep. I awoke before the first light with a foreboding of danger. Beside me, the fool slept heavily. I touched his face and found it warm still and misted with sweat. I rolled away from him, tucking the blankets in tight around him. I added a twig or two of precious fuel to the brazier and began drawing my clothes on quietly. Night Eyes was immediately alert.
Going out? Just a sniff about. Shall I come?
Keep the fool warm. I won't be long.
Are you sure you'll be all right?
I'll be very careful. I promise.
The cold was like a slap. The darkness, absolute. After a moment or two, my eyes adjusted, but even so, I could see little more than the tent itself. An overcast had blotted the stars even. I stood still in the icy wind, straining my senses to find what had disturbed me. It was not the skill, but my wit that quested out into the darkness for me. I sensed our party, and the hunger of the huddled Jeppas. Grain alone would not keep them long. Another worry. Resolutely I set it aside and pushed my senses further. I stiffened.
Horses?
Yes.
And riders?
I thought so.
Night Eyes was suddenly beside me.
Can you scent them?
The wind is wrong. Shall I go see?
Yes, but be unseen.
Of course, see to the fool,
he whimpered when I left him. In the tent, I quietly woke Ketrickin.
I think there may be danger,
I told her softly. Horses and riders possibly on the road behind us, I'm not certain yet.
By the time we are certain, they will be here,
she said dourly.
Wake everyone. I want us up and ready to move by light.
The fool is still feverish,
I said, even as I stooped and shook Starling's shoulder.
If he stays here, he won't be feverish. He'll be dead, and you with him. Has the wolf gone to spy for us?
Yes. I knew she was right, but it was still hard to force myself to shake the fool to consciousness. He moved like a man in a daze. While the others bundled our gear, I hurried him into his coat and nagged him into an extra pair of leggings. I wrapped him in all our blankets and stood him outside, while the rest of us struck the tent and loaded it. Of Ketrickin, I asked quietly,
"How much weight can a Jeppa bear?"
"More than the fool weighs.
But they are too narrow to straddle comfortably, and they are skittish with a live load. We might put him on one for a ways, but it would be uncomfortable for him, and the Jeppa would be difficult to control."
It was the answer I had expected, but it did not make me happy.
"What news from the wolf?"
she asked me. I reached for Night Eyes and was dismayed to find what an effort it was to touch minds with him.
Six riders, I told her.
Friend or foe? She asked.
He has no way to know.
I pointed out to her.
To the wolf, I asked. How do the horses look?
Delicious.
Large like sooty or small like mountain horses?
Between. One pack mule.
They are horses, not mountain ponies, I told Ketrickin. She shook her head to herself.
Most of my folk do not use horses this high in the mountains. They would use ponies or jeppas. Let us decide they are enemies and act accordingly.
Run or fight?
Both, of course.
She had already taken her bow from one of the jeppas' loads. Now she strung it to have it ready.
First we look for a better place to stage an ambush. Then we wait. Let's go.
It was easier said than done. Only the smoothness of the road made it possible at all. Light was only a rumor as we started that day. Starling led the jeppers ahead. I brought the fool behind them, while Kettle with her staff and Ketrickin with her bow followed us. At first I let the fool try to walk on his own. He lurched slowly along, and as the jeppers drew inexorably away from us, I knew it would not do. I put his left arm across my shoulders and my arm about his waist and hurried him along. In a short time, he was panting and struggling to keep his feet from dragging. The unnatural warmth of his body was frightening. Cruelly, I forced him on, praying for cover of some sort. When we came to it, it was not the kindness of trees, but the cruelty of sharp stone. A great portion of the mountain above the road had given way and cascaded down. It had carried off more than half the road with it, and left what remained heaped high with stone and earth. Starling and the jeppers were looking at it dubiously when the fool and I limped up. I set him down on a stone, where he sat, eyes closed and head bowed. I pulled the blankets more closely around him, and then went to stand by Starling.
It's an old slide, she observed. Maybe it won't be that hard to scramble across it.
Maybe, I agreed, my eyes already looking for a place to attempt it. Snow overlaid the stone, cloaking it. If I go first with the jeppers, can you follow with the fool?
I suppose. She glanced over at him. How bad is she?
There was only worry in Starling's voice, so I swallowed my annoyance. He can stagger along if he has an arm to lean on. Don't start to follow until the last animal is up and moving across it. Then follow our tracks. Starling bobbed her head in agreement, but did not look happy.
Shouldn't we wait for Ketrickin and Kettle?
I thought. No. If those riders do catch up with us, I don't want to be here with stone at my back. We cross the slide. I wished the wolf were with us, for he was twice as sure-footed as I and much quicker of reflex.
Can't come to you without their seeing me. It's sheer rock above and below the road here, and they are between you and me.
Don't fret about it. Just watch them and keep me alerted. Do they travel swiftly?
They walk their horses and argue much among themselves. One is fat and weary of riding. He says little, but he does not hasten. Be careful, my brother.
I took a deep breath and, as no place looked better than any other, simply followed my nose. At first, there was just a scattering of loose stone across the road, but beyond that was a wall of great boulders, rocky soil, and loose, sharp-edged stone. I picked my way up this treacherous footing, the lead jeppa following me, and the others came behind her unquestioningly. I soon found that blowing snow had frozen across the rocks in thin sheets, often covering hollows and cracks beneath them. I stepped carelessly on one and thrust my leg down to my knee in a crack. I extricated myself carefully and proceeded. When I took a moment and looked around me, my courage almost failed. Above me was a great slope of slide debris going up to a sheer wall of rock. I walked on a hillside of loose rock and stone. Looking ahead,
I could not see where it ended. If it gave way, I would tumble and slide with it to the edge of the road and shoot off it into the deep valley beyond. There would be nothing, not a twig of greenery, not a boulder of any size that I could cling to. Small things became suddenly frightening. The Jeppa's nervous tugging at the lead rope I clutched, a sudden shift in the push of the breeze, even my hair blowing in my eyes, were abruptly life-threatening. Twice I dropped to all fours and crawled. The rest of the way I went at a crouch, looking before I placed a foot and trusting my weight to it slowly. Behind me came the line of Jeppas, all following the lead beast. They were not as cautious as I. I heard stones shift beneath them, and small scatterings of rock that they loosened went pebbling and bounding down the slope to shoot off in space. Each time it happened, I feared it would waken other rocks and set them sliding. They were not roped together, save for the lead I had on the first beast. At any moment I dreaded to see one go slipping down the hillside. They were strung out behind me like corks on a net, and far behind them came Starling and the fool. I stopped once to watch them and cursed myself as I realized the difficulty of the task I had given her. They came at half my crawling pace, with Starling gripping the fool and watching footing for both of them. My heart was in my mouth when she stumbled once and the fool sprawled flat beside her. She looked up then and saw me staring back at her. Angrily, she lifted an arm and motioned me to go on. I did. There was nothing else I could do. The dump of rock and stone ended as abruptly as it had begun. I scrabbled down to the road's flat surface with gratitude. Behind me came the lead Jeppa, and then the other beasts, jumping from scarp to rock to road, like goats as they descended. As soon as they were all down, I scattered some grain on the road to keep them well bunched, and clambered back up the slide's shoulder. I could see neither Starling nor the fool. I wanted to run back across the face of the slide. Instead, I forced myself to go slowly, picking my way back along the tracks the Jeppas and I had left. I told myself that I should be able to see their brightly colored garments in this dull landscape of grays and blacks and whites, and finally I did. Starling was sitting quite still in a patch of scree, with the fool stretched out beside her on the stones. "Starling!" I called to her softly. She looked up. Her eyes were huge. "It all started to move around us, little rocks and then bigger ones, so I stopped still to let it settle. Now I can't get the fool up and I can't carry her." She fought the panic in her voice. "Sit still. I'm coming." I could plainly see where a section of the surface rock had broken loose and started tumbling. Rolling pebbles had left their tracks over the snowy surface. I sized up what I could see and wished I knew more of avalanches. The movement of stone seemed to have begun well above them and to have flowed past them. We were still a good ways above the edge, but once the scree began moving, it would swiftly carry us over the edge. I made my heart cold and relied on my head. "Starling!" I called to her softly again. It was needless. Her attention was entirely focused on me. "Come to me, very slowly and carefully."
"What about the fool?"
"Leave him. Once you are safe, I will go back for him. If I come to you, all three of us will be at risk." It is one thing to see the logic of something. It is another to force oneself to keep a resolve that smacks of cowardice. I do not know what Starling was thinking as she got slowly to her feet. She never straightened up entirely, but ventured toward me one slow step at a time, crouched over. I bit my lip and kept silent, though I longed to urge her to hurry. Twice small herds of pebbles were loosened by her steps. They went cascading downhill, rousing others to join them as they flowed down the incline and then bounded over the edge. Each time she froze in a crouch, her eyes fixed desperately on me. I stood and stupidly wondered what I would do if she started to slide with the rocks. Would I fling myself uselessly after her, or watch her go and keep forever the memory of those dark eyes pleading? But at last she reached the relative safety of the larger rocks where I stood. She clutched at me, and I held her, feeling the trembling that rattled through her. After a long moment I gripped her upper arms firmly and held her a little apart from me. "You have to go on now. It's not far. When you get there, stay there and keep the jeppas bunched together. Do you understand?" She gave a quick nod, and then took a deep breath. She stepped free of me and began cautiously to follow the trail the jeppas and I had left. I let her get a safe distance away before I took my first cautious steps toward the fool. The rocks shifted and grated more noticeably under my greater weight. I wondered if I would be wiser to walk higher or lower on the slope than she had. I thought of going back to the jeppas for a rope, but could think of nothing to secure it to. And all the while I kept moving forward, one cautious step at a time. The fool himself did not move. Rocks began to move around my feet, tapping against my ankles as they tumbled past me, slipping out from under my feet. I halted where I was, frozen by the gravel hurrying past me. I felt one of my feet start to slip, and before I could control myself, I plunged forward a step. The exodus of small rocks became swifter and more determined. I did not know what to do. I thought of flinging myself flat and spreading my weight, but decided swiftly it would only make it more easy for the tumbling rocks to carry me with them. Not one of the moving stones was bigger than my fist, but there were so many of them. I froze where I was and counted 10 breaths before the rattlings settled again. It took every scrap of courage I could muster to take the next step. I studied the ground for a time and selected a place that looked least unstable. I eased my weight to that foot and chose a place for my next step. By the time I reached the fool's prone body, my shirt was sweated to my back and my jaw ached from clenching it. I eased myself down beside him. Starling had lifted the blanket's corner to shelter his face, and he still lay covered like a dead man. I lifted it away to look down at his closed eyes. He was a hue I had never seen before. The deathly white of his skin at Buckkeep had taken on a yellowish cast in the mountains, but now he was a terrible dead color. His lips were dry and chapped, his eyelashes crusted yellow, and he was still warm to the touch. "Fool?" I asked him gently, but he made no response. I spoke on, hoping some part of him would hear me. "I'm going to have to lift you and carry you. The footing is bad, and if I slip, we're going to fall all the way. So once I have you up in my arms, you must be very, very still. Do you understand?" He took a slightly deeper breath. I took it for assent. I knelt downhill of him and worked my hands and arms under his body. As I straightened up, the arrow scar in my back screamed. I felt sweat pop out on my face. I knelt upright for a moment, the fool in my arms, mastering my pain and gaining my balance. I shifted one leg to get my foot under me. I tried to stand up slowly, but as I did so, rocks began cascading past me. I fought a terrible urge to clutch the fool to me and run. The rattling and scattering of loose shale went on and on and on. When it finally ceased, I was trembling with the effort of standing perfectly still. I was ankle deep in loose scree. "Fitzchivalry!" I turned my head slowly. Ketrickin and Kettle had caught up. They were standing uphill of me, well off the patch of loosened stone. They both looked sickened at my predicament. Ketrikin was the first to recover.
"Ketil and I are going to cross above you. Stay where you are and be as still as you can. Did Starling and the Jeppers make it across?"
I managed a small nod. I had not the spit to speak.
"I'll get a rope and come back. I'll be as quick as it is safe to be."
Another nod from me. I had to twist my body to watch them, so I did not. Nor did I look down. The wind blew past me, the stone ticked under my feet, and I looked down into the fool's face. He did not weigh much for a man grown. He had always been slight and bird-boned, relying on his tongue for defense, rather than fist and muscle. But as I stood and held him, he grew weightier and weightier in my arms. The circle of pain in my back slowly expanded, and somehow managed to make my arms ache with it. I felt him give a slight twitch in my arms.
"Be still,"
I whispered. He prized his eyes open and looked up at me. His tongue sought to moisten his lips.
"What are we doing?"
he croaked.
"We're standing very still in the middle of an avalanche,"
I whispered back. My throat was so dry it was hard to talk.
"I think I could stand,"
he offered weakly.
"Don't move,"
I ordered him. He took a slightly deeper breath.
"Why are you always near when I get into these sort of situations?"
he wondered hoarsely.
"I could ask you the same,"
I retorted unfairly.
"Fitz!"
I twisted my screaming back to look up at Ketrikin. She was silhouetted against the sky. She had a Jepper with her, the lead one. She had a coil of rope looped on one shoulder. The other end was fixed to the Jepper's empty pack harness.
"I'm going to throw the rope to you. Don't try to catch it. Let it go past you, and then pick it up and wrap it around yourself, understand?"
"Yes."
She could not have heard my answer, but she nodded back to me encouragingly. In a moment, the rope came flopping and uncoiling past me. It unsettled a small amount of pebbles, but their scurrying motion was enough to make me sick. The length of the rope sprawled across the rock, less than an arm's length from my foot. I looked down at it and tasted despair. I steeled my will.
"Fool, can you hold on to me? I have to try to pick up the rope." "I think I can stand,"
he offered again.
"You may have to,"
I admitted unwillingly.
"Be ready for anything but whatever else. Hold on to me."
"Only if you promise to hold on to the rope."
"I'll do my best,"
I promised grimly.
"My brother, they have stopped where we camped last night. Of the 6 men..."
"Not now, Night Eyes."
"3 have gone down as you did, and 3 remain with the horses."
"Not now."
The fool shifted his arms to get an awkward hold on my shoulders. The damnable blankets that had swathed him were everywhere I did not want them to be. I clutched at the fool with my left arm, and got my right hand and arm somewhat clear, even though my arm was still under him. I fought a ridiculous impulse to laugh. It was all so stupidly awkward and dangerous. Of all the ways I had thought I might die, this one had never occurred to me. I met the fool's eyes and saw the same panicky laughter in them.
"Ready?"
I told him, and crouched toward the rope. Every taut muscle in my body screeched and cramped. My fingers failed to touch the rope by a hand's breadth. I glanced up to where Ketrikin and the Jepper were anxiously poised. It came to me that I had no idea what was supposed to happen once I had the rope. But my muscles were already extended too far to stop and ask questions. I forced my hand to the rope, even as I felt my right foot sliding out from under me. Everything happened simultaneously. The fool's grip on me tightened convulsively as the whole hillside beneath us seemed to break into motion. I grasped the rope, but was still sliding downhill.
Just before it tightened, I managed to flip one wrap around my waist. Above us, and to the east of us, Ketrickin led the sure-footed Jepper on. I saw the animal stagger as it took part of our weight. It dug in its feet and kept moving across the slide zone. The rope tightened, biting into my wrist and hand. I held on. I don't know how I scrabbled my feet under me, but I did, and made a semblance of walking as the hill kept rattling away beneath me. I found myself swinging like a slow pendulum, with the taut rope providing me just enough resistance to keep me atop the rattling stone sliding downhill past me. Suddenly I felt firmer footing. My boots were full of tiny pebbles, but I ignored them as I kept my grip on the rope and moved steadily across the slide area. By now, we were far downhill of the original path I had chosen. I refused to look down and see how close we were to the edge. I concentrated on keeping my awkward grip on the fool and the rope, and keeping my feet moving. Abruptly, we were out of danger. I found myself in an area of bigger rocks, free of the loose scree that had nearly ended our lives. Above us, Ketrickin kept moving steadily, and so did we. And then we were climbing down into the blessedly level roadbed. In a few more minutes, we were all on flat, snowy ground. I dropped the rope, and slowly sagged down with the fool. I closed my eyes.
"Here, drink some water."
It was Kettle's voice, and she was offering me a water skin as Ketrickin and Starling pried the fool out of my arms. I drank some water and shook for a short while. Every part of me hurt as if bruised. As I sat recovering, something pushed into the front of my mind. I suddenly staggered to my feet. "Six of them, and three have gone down as I did," he said. All eyes turned to me at my blurted words. Kettle was getting water down the fool, but he did not look much better. Her mouth was pursed with worry and displeasure. I knew what she feared. But the fear the wolf had given me was more compelling.
"What did you say?"
Ketrickin asked me gently, and I realized they thought my mind was wandering again. "Night Eyes has been following them. Six men on horses, one pack animal. They stopped at our old campsite, and he said that three of them went down as I did."
"Meaning to the city?"
Ketrickin asked slowly.
"To the city,"
Night Eyes echoed. It chilled me to see Ketrickin nod as if to herself.
"How can that be?"
Starling asked softly. "Kettle told us the signpost only worked for you because you had had skill training. It didn't affect any of the rest of us."
"They must be skilled ones,"
Kettle said softly, and looked at me questioningly. There was only one answer.
"Regal's coterie,"
I said, and shuddered. The sickness of dread rose in me. They were so horribly close, and they knew how to hurt me so badly. An overwhelming fear of pain flooded my mind. I fought panic. Ketrickin patted my arm awkwardly.
"Fitz, they'll not get past that slide easily. With my bow, I can pick them off as they cross."
Ketrickin offered these words. There was irony in my queen offering to protect the royal assassin. Somehow it steadied me, even as I knew her bow was no protection from the coterie.
"They don't need to come here to attack me."
"Or Verity." I took a deep breath, and suddenly heard an additional fact in my words.
"They don't need to physically follow us here to attack us. So why have they come all this way?"
The fool leaned up on an elbow. He rubbed at his pasty face.
"Maybe they don't come here to pursue you at all,"
he suggested slowly.
"Maybe they want something else."
"What?" I demanded.
"What did Verity come for?"
he demanded. His voice was weak, but he seemed to be thinking very carefully. "The aid of the elderlings. Regal never believed in them. He saw it only as a way to get Verity out of his path."
"Perhaps. but he knew the tale he spread of Verity's death was a fabrication of his own. You yourself say that his coterie waited and spied upon you. In what hopes, if not to discover Verity's whereabouts? By now he must wonder as much as the Queen does. Why has Verity not returned? And Regal must wonder what errand was so important that the bastard turned aside from killing him to set forth on it. Look behind you, Fitz. You have left a trail of blood and mayhem. Regal must wonder where it all ends.
Why would they go down into the city? I asked. And then a worse question. How did they know how to go down into the city? I blundered into it, but how did they know?
Perhaps they are far stronger than you in the skill. Perhaps the guidepost spoke to them, or perhaps they came here already knowing much more than you did.
Kettle spoke carefully, but there was no perhaps in her voice. It was all suddenly clear to me.
I don't know why they are here, but I know I am going to kill them before they can get to Verity, or trouble me any further.
I heaved myself to my feet. Starling sat staring at me. I think she realized at the moment exactly what I was, not some romanticized princeling in exile who would eventually do some heroic task, but a killer. And not even a very competent one.
Rest a bit first,
Ketrickin advised me. Her voice was steady and accepting. I shook my head.
I wish I could,
but the opportunity they've given me is now. I don't know how long they'll be in the city. I hope they'll spend some time there. I'm not going down to meet them, you see. I'm no match for them in the skill. I can't fight their minds, but I can kill their bodies. If they've left their horses, guards, and supplies behind them, I can take those things from them. Then when they come back, they'll be trapped. No food, no shelter, no game to hunt around here, even if they remembered how to hunt. I won't get a chance as good as this again. Ketrickin was nodding reluctantly. Starling looked ill. The fool had sagged back into his bedding.
I should be going with you,
he said quietly. I looked at him and tried to keep amusement out of my voice.
You?
I've just a feeling that I should go with you, that you should not go alone.
I won't be alone. Night Eyes is waiting for me. I quested out briefly and found my comrade. He was crouched on his belly in the snow, down trail of the guards and horses. They had built a small fire and were cooking food over it. It was making the wolf hungry.
Shall we have horse tonight?
We shall see,
I told him. I turned to Ketrickin. May I take your bow? She handed it over reluctantly.
Can you shoot it?
She asked. It was a very fine weapon. Not well, but well enough. They've no cover worth mentioning, and they aren't expecting an attack. If I'm lucky, I can kill one before they know I'm even around.
You'll shoot one without even issuing a challenge?
Starling asked faintly. I looked into the sudden disillusionment in her eyes. I closed my eyes and focused on my task instead.
Night Eyes, shall I drive the horses over the cliff, or just down the trail? They've already scented me and are getting anxious, but the men pay no attention. I'd like the supplies they're carrying, if it can be managed.
Why did killing a horse bother me more than killing a man?
We'll see.
Night Eyes replied judiciously. Meat is meat, he added. I slung Ketrickin's quiver over my back. The wind was kicking up again, promising more snow. The thought of crossing the slide area again turned my bowels to water.
There is no choice,
I reminded myself. I looked up to see Starling turning away from me. She had evidently taken my remark as her reply. Well, it would serve there as well. If I fail, they will come after you, I said carefully. You should get as far from here as you can. Travel until you can't see any more. If all goes well, we'll catch up with you soon enough. I crouched down beside the fool.
Can you walk at all?
I asked him.
Far away,
he said dully.
If I must, I can carry him.
Ketrickin spoke with quiet certainty. I looked at the tall woman and believed her. I gave her a short nod of my head.
"Wish me luck,"
I told them, and turned back to the slide zone.
"I'm coming with you,"
Kettle announced abruptly. She stood up from retying her boots.
"Give me the bow, and follow where I walk."
I was speechless for a moment.
"Why?"
I demanded at last.
"Because I know what I'm doing crossing that rock, and I'm more than good enough with a bow. I'll wager I can drop two of them before they know we're there."
"But she is very good on the slide," Ketrickin observed calmly. "Starling, take the jeppas. I'll bring the fool." She gave us an unreadable look. "Catch up as soon as you can." I recalled that I'd tried to leave Kettle behind once before. If she was going with me, I wanted her to be with me, not coming up behind me when I didn't expect it. I glared at her, but nodded.
"The bow,"
she reminded me. "Can you really shoot well?" I asked her as I grudgingly surrendered it. A funny smile twisted her face. She looked down at her crooked fingers.
"I would not tell you I could do a thing if I could not. Some of my old skills are still mine,"
she said quietly. We set out to clamber back up onto the tumbled rock. Kettle went first, her probing staff in hand, and I came behind her, one staff length back as she had bid me. She didn't say a word to me as she glanced back and forth between the ground at her feet and where she wished to take us. I could not discern what it was that decided her path, but the loose stone and crystalline snow remained quiet under her short steps. She made it look easy enough that I began to feel foolish. "They are eating now, and no one keeps a watch." I relayed the information to Kettle, who nodded grimly. To myself I fretted and wondered if she would be able to do what needed doing. To be good with a bow is one thing. To shoot a man down while he is eating his dinner peacefully is another. I thought of Starling's objection, and wondered what kind of man would show himself and issue a challenge before trying to kill all three men. I touched the hilt of my short sword. Well, it was what Chade had promised me so long ago. Killing for my king, with none of the honor or glory of the soldier on the battlefield. Not that any of my battle memories had much of honor or glory in them. We were suddenly clambering down from the loose rock of the slide area, going very quietly and carefully. Kettle spoke very softly.
"We've a ways to go yet, but when we get there, let me choose my spot and get my first shot off. As soon as the man is down, show yourself and draw their attention. They may not look for me, and I may get another clean shot."
"Have you done this sort of thing before?"
I asked softly.
"It's not that different from our game, Fitz. From here. Let us go silently."
I knew then she had not killed this way before, if she had ever killed a human before at all. I began to doubt the wisdom of giving her the bow. At the same time, I was selfishly grateful for her companionship. I wondered if I were losing my courage.
"Perhaps you are learning that a pack is best for such things."
"Perhaps." There was little cover on the road. Above and below us, the mountainside rose sheer. The road itself was flat and bare. We rounded a shoulder of the mountain, and their camp was in plain sight. All three guards still sat carelessly about the fire, eating and talking. The horses caught our scent and shifted with small snortings. But as the wolf had kept them uneasy for some time, the men paid them no mind. Kettle set an arrow to her bow as we walked and carried it, ready. In the end, it was simple. Ugly, mindless slaughter, but simple. She let go her arrow when one of the men noticed us. It took him through the chest. The other two leaped to their feet, turned to see us, and dived for their weapons. But in that short space of time, Kettle had knocked another arrow and let fly as the helpless wretch drew a sword clear. Night Eyes came suddenly from behind to bear the last man down and hold him until I could rush in to finish him with a sword. It had happened swiftly, almost quietly. Three dead men sprawled in the snow, six sweating, restless horses, one impassive mule. "Kettle, see what food they have on the horses," I told her, to stop her awful staring. She swung her gaze to me, then slowly nodded. I went over to the bodies to see what they might tell me. They did not wear Regal's colors, but the origin of two were plain in the features of their faces and the cut of their clothes. Pharaoh men. The third one, when I turned him over, near stopped my heart. I'd known him in Buckkeep, not well, but enough to know his name was Tallow. I crouched, looking down into his dead face, ashamed that I could recall no more of him than that. I supposed he had gone on to Tradeford when Regal moved the court there. Many of the servants had. I tried to tell myself it did not matter where he had begun. He had ended here. I closed my heart and did my tasks. I tumbled the bodies off the cliff's edge, while Kettle went through their stores and sorted out what she thought we two could carry back. I stripped the horses of every bit of harness and tack. This followed the bodies down the cliff. I went through their bags, finding little besides warm clothes. The pack animal carried only their tent and such things, no papers. What need would coterie members have of written instructions? "Drive the horses well down the road. I doubt they'll come back here on their own."
"That much meat? And you want me to just chase it away?"
"If we kill one here, it's more than we can eat and carry. Whatever we left would feed those three when they return. They were carrying dry meat and cheese. I'll see your belly is full tonight." Night Eyes was not pleased, but he heeded me. I think he chased the horses farther and faster than he truly needed to, but at least he left them alive. I had no idea what their chances were in the mountains, probably end up in a snowcat's belly, or as a feast for the ravens. I was suddenly, horribly tired of it all. "Shall we go on?" I asked Kettle, needlessly, and she nodded. It was a good trove of food she had packed for us to carry, but I privately wondered if I'd be able to stomach any of it. What little we could not carry, nor the wolf stuff down, I kicked over the edge. I looked around us. Dare I touch it? I'd try to push that pillar over the edge, too, I told Kettle. She gave me a look as if she thought I had asked it of her.
"I fear to touch it also,"
she said at last, and we both turned away from it. Evening crept across the mountains as we went up the road, and night came swift on her heels. I followed Kettle and the wolf across the landslide, in near darkness. Neither of them seemed afraid, and I was suddenly too weary to care if I survived the trek.
"Don't let your mind wander,"
Kettle chided me, as we finally came down off the tumble of stone and onto the road again. She took my arm and gripped it tightly. We walked for a time in almost blackness, simply following the straight, flat road before us as it cut across the face of a mountain. The wolf went ahead of us, coming back frequently to check on us.
"Camp's not much farther," he encouraged me after one such trip.
"How long have you been doing this?"
Kettle asked me after a time. I didn't pretend to misunderstand the question. "Since I was about 12, I told her.
"How many men have you killed?"
It was not the cold question it sounded. I answered her seriously. "I don't know. My teacher advised me against keeping account. He said it wasn't a good idea." Those weren't his exact words. I remembered them well. "How many doesn't matter after one," Chade had said. "We know what we are. Quantity makes you neither better nor worse." I pondered now what he had meant by that, as Kettle said to the dark,
I killed once before.
I made no reply. I'd let her tell me about it if she wanted, but I really didn't want to know. Her arm, in mine, began to tremble slightly.
I killed her in a temper. I didn't think I could. She had always been stronger. But I lived, and she died. So they burned me out and turned me out, sent me into exile forever.
Her hand found mine and gripped it tightly. We kept on walking. Ahead of us I spied a tiny glow. It was almost likely the braziers burning inside the tent.
It was so unthinkable to do what I had done,
Kettle said wearily.
It had never happened before. Oh, between coteries, certainly, once in a great while, for rivalry for the king's favour, but I skill-dueled a member of my own coterie, and killed her. And that was unforgivable.
29. The Rooster Crown. There is a game played among the mountain folk. It is a complex game to learn and a difficult one to master. It features a combination of cards and rune chips. There are 17 cards, usually about the size of a man's hand and made from any light-colored wood. Each of these cards features an emblem from mountain lore, such as the old weaver man or she who tracks. The renderings of these highly stylized images are usually done in paint over a burnt outline. The 31 rune chips are made from a grey stone peculiar to the mountains and are incised with glyphs for stone, water, pasture, and the like. The cards and stones are dealt out to the players, usually three, until no more remain. Both cards and runes have traditional weights that are varied when they are played in combination. It is reputed to be a very old game. We walked the rest of the way to the tent, in silence. What she had told me was so immense I could not think of anything to say. It would have been stupid to voice the hundreds of questions that sprang up in me. She had the answers, and she would choose when to give them to me. I knew that now. Night Eyes came back to me silently and swiftly. He slunk close to my heels.
She killed within her pack?
So it seems.
It happens. It is not good, but it happens. Tell her that.
Not just now. No one said much as we came into the tent. No one wanted to ask. So I quietly said, "We killed the guards and drove off the horses and threw their supplies off the cliff." Starling only stared at us, without comprehension. Her eyes were wide and dark, bird-like. Ketrickin poured mugs of tea for us and quietly added the stores of food we had brought to our own dwindling supplies.
"The fool is a bit better,"
she offered, by way of conversation. I looked at him sleeping in his blankets, and doubted it. His eyes had a sunken look. Sweat had plastered his fine hair to his skull, and his restless sleep had stood it up in tufts. But when I set my hand to his face, it was almost cool to the touch. I snugged the blanket closer around him.
"Did he eat anything?"
I asked Ketrickin.
"He drank some soup. I think he'll be all right, Fitz. He was sick once before, for a day or so in Blue Lake. It was the same, fever and weakness. He said then that it might not be a sickness, but only a change his kind go through. He said somewhat the same to me yesterday."
I agreed. She put a bowl of warm soup in my hands. For an instant, it smelled good. Then it smelled like the remains of the soup the panicked guards had spilled on the snowy road. I clenched my jaws.
"Did you see the coterie members at all?"
Ketrickin asked me. I shook my head, then forced myself to speak.
"No.
But there was a big horse there, and the clothing in his bags would have fit Burl. In another,
There were blue garments, such as Carad favors, and austere things for Will. I said their names awkwardly, in a way fearing to name them lest I summon them. In another way, I was naming those I had killed, skilled or not, the mountains would make an end of them. Yet I took no pride in what I had done, nor would I completely believe it until I saw their bones. All I knew for now was that it was not likely they would attack me this night. For an instant, I imagined them returning to the pillar, expecting to find food and fire and shelter awaiting them. They would find cold and dark. They would not see the blood on the snow. I realized the soup was getting cold. I forced myself to eat it, mouthfuls that I simply swallowed, not wishing to taste. Tallow had played the penny whistle. I had a sudden memory of him, sitting on the back steps outside the scullery, playing for a couple of kitchen maids. I shut my eyes, wishing vainly that I could recall something evil about him. I suspected his only crime had been serving the wrong master.
"Fitz!"
Kettle instantly poked me. "I wasn't wandering," I complained.
"You would have soon. Fear has been your ally this day. It has kept you focused. But you must sleep sometime tonight, and when you do, you must have your mind well warded. When they get back to the pillar, they will recognize your handiwork and come hunting you. Do you not think so?"
I knew it was so. But it was still unsettling to hear it spoken aloud. I wished Ketrickin and Starling were not listening and watching us.
"So, we shall have a bit of our game again, shall we?"
Kettle cajoled. We played four chance games. I won twice. Then she set up a game with almost entirely white pieces, and gave me one black stone with which to win. I tried to focus my mind on the game, knowing it had worked before, but I was simply too tired. I found myself thinking it had been over a year since I had left Buck Keep as a corpse. Over a year since I had slept in a real bed I called my own. Over a year since meals had been reliable. Over a year since I had held Molly in my arms. Over a year since she had bid me leave her alone forever.
"Fitz, don't."
I lifted my eyes from the game cloth to find Kettle watching me closely.
"You can't indulge that. You have to be strong."
"I am too tired to be strong."
"Your enemies were careless today. They did not expect you to discover them. They won't be careless again."
"I hope they'll be dead," I said with a cheer I did not feel.
"Not that easily,"
Ketrickin replied, unknowing of how her words chilled me.
"You said it was warmer down in the city. Once they see they've no supplies, they'll go back to the city. They have water there, and I'm sure they took at least some supplies for the day. I don't think we can disregard them yet. Do you?"
"I suppose not." Night Eyes sat up beside me with an anxious whine. I quelled my own despair and then quieted him with a touch.
"I just wish,"
I said quietly, "that I could simply sleep for a time. Alone, in my mind, dreaming my own dreams without fearing where I'll go or who might attack me, without fearing that my hunger for the skill will overcome me. Just simple sleep." I spoke to her directly, knowing now she understood well what I meant.
"I can't give you that,"
Kettle told me calmly.
"All I can give you is the game. Trust it. It's been used by generations of skill users to keep such dangers at bay."
And so I bent to the board once more and fixed the game in my mind. And when I lay down by the fool that night, I kept it before my eyes. I hovered that night, like a nectar bird, somewhere between sleep and wakefulness. I could reach a place just short of sleep and keep myself there by contemplating Kettle's game. More than once I drifted back to wakefulness. I would become cognizant of the dim light from the brazier and the sleeping forms beside me.
Several times I reached out to check the fool. Each time his skin seemed cooler, and his own sleep deeper. Ketriken, Starling, and Kettle rotated through watches that night. I noticed that the wolf shared Ketriken's. They still did not trust me to remain wary through one. And I was selfishly grateful for that. Just short of dawn, I stirred once more to find all still quiet. I checked the fool, and then lay back and closed my eyes, hoping to find a few more moments of rest. Instead, in horrific detail, I beheld a great eye, as if the closing of my own eyes had opened this one. I struggled to open my own eyes again. I floundered desperately toward wakefulness. But I was held. There was a terrible pull on my mind, like the sucking pull of an undertow on a swimmer. I resisted with all my will. I could feel wakefulness just above me, like a bubble I could break into, if only I could touch it. But I could not. I struggled, grimacing my face, trying to pull my wayward eyes open. The eye watched me. One single, immense, dark eye, not Will's. Regal's. He stared at me, and I knew he took delight in my struggles. It seemed effortless for him to hold me there, like a fly under a glass bowl. Yet even in my panic, I knew that if he could have done more than hold me, he would. He had got past my walls, but had not the power to do more than threaten me. That was still enough to make my heart pound with terror. "Bastard," he said fondly. The word broke over my mind like a cold ocean wave. I was drenched in its threat. "Bastard, I know about the child. And your woman, Molly. Tit for tat, bastard." He paused, and his amusement grew as my terror swelled. "Now there's a thought. Has she pretty tits, bastard? Would I find her amusing?"
"No!"
I wrenched clear of him, sensing for an instant Carrad, Burl, and Will as well. I flung myself free. I came awake abruptly. I scrabbled from my bedding and fled outside, bootless and uncloaked. Night Eyes followed at my heels, snarling in every direction. The sky was black and scattered with stars. The air was cold. I drew breath after shuddering breath of it, trying to still the sick fear in me. "What is it?" Starling demanded fearfully. She was on watch outside the tent. I just shook my head at her, unable to voice the horror of it. After a time, I turned and went back inside. Sweat was coursing down my body, as if I had been poisoned. I sat down in the muddle of blankets. I could not stop panting. The more I tried to still my panic, the greater it became.
"I know about the child. And your woman."
Those words echoed and echoed through me. Kettle stirred in her bedding, then rose and came across the tent to sit behind me. She set her hands on my shoulders.
"They broke through to you, didn't they?"
I nodded, tried to swallow with a dry throat. She reached for a water skin and handed it to me. I took a drink, almost choked, and then managed another swallow.
"Think about the game," she urged me. "Clear your mind of everything but the game."
"The game?" I cried out savagely, jerking both the fool and Ketriken awake. "The game? Regal knows about Molly and Nettle. He threatens them. And I am powerless, helpless." I felt the panic building in me again, the unfocused fury. The wolf whined, then growled deep in his throat.
"Can't you skill to them, warn them somehow?" Ketriken asked.
"No!" Kettle cut in. "He should not even think of them."
Ketriken gave me a look that mingled apology and righteousness.
"I fear Chade and I were correct. The princess will be safer in the Mountain Kingdom. Do not forget that his task was to fetch her. Take heart.
Perhaps even now Nettle is with him, on her way to safety. Out of Regal's touch.
Kettle called my gaze away from the Queen.
Fitz! Focus on the game, only on the game. His threats could be a ploy to trick you into betraying them. Don't talk about them, don't think about them. Here! Look here!
Her trembling old hands moved my blanket away and spread out the game cloth. She spilled stones into her hand and plucked out white ones to recreate the problem.
Solve this. Focus on this, and this only.
It was next to impossible. I looked at the white stones and thought it all a stupid task. What players could be so clumsy and short-sighted as to let the game degrade into such a clutter of white stones? It was not a problem worth solving, but neither could I lie down and sleep. I scarcely dared blink lest I see that eye again. Had it been Regal's whole countenance or both his eyes, it would not perhaps have seemed so awful. But the disembodied eye seemed all-seeing, inconstant, inescapable. I stared at the game pieces until the white stone seemed to float above the junctures of the lines. One black stone to bring a winning pattern out of this chaos. One black stone. I held it in my hand, rubbing it with my thumb. All the next day, as we followed the road down the mountain's flank, I held the stone in my bare hand. My other arm was about the fool's waist, his arm around my neck. These two things kept my mind focused. The fool seemed somewhat better. His body was no longer feverish, but he seemed unable to stomach food, or even tea. Kettle forced water on him until he simply sat and refused it, shaking his head wordlessly. He seemed as indisposed to talk as I was. Starling, and Kettle with her staff, led our weary little procession. The fool and I followed the Jeppers, while Ketrickin, with her bow strung, kept our rear guarded. The wolf prowled restlessly up and down the line, now ranging ahead, now loping up our back trail. Night-Eyes and I had gone back to a sort of wordless bond. He understood that I did not wish to think at all, and did his best not to distract me. It was still unnerving to sense him trying to use the wit to communicate with Ketrickin.
No sign of anyone behind us,
he would tell her, as he trotted past on one of his endless trips. Then he would go ranging far ahead of the Jeppers and Starling, only to come back to Ketrickin and assure her in passing that all was clear ahead of us. I tried to tell myself that she merely had faith that Night-Eyes would let me know if he found anything amiss on his scouting trips. But I suspected she was becoming more and more attuned to him. The road led us very swiftly downward. As we descended, the land changed. By late afternoon, the slope above the road was gentling, and we began to pass twisted trees and mossy boulders. Snow faded and became patchy on the hillside, while the road was dry and black. Dry tufts of grass showed green at their bases just off the shoulder of the road. It was hard to make the hungry Jeppers keep moving. I made a vague wit effort to let them know that there would be better browsing ahead, but I doubt that I had enough familiarity with them to make any lasting impression on them. I tried to limit my thoughts to the fact that firewood would be more plentiful tonight, and to gratitude that the lower the road carried us, the warmer grew the day. At one time, the fool made a gesture to a low, growing plant that had tiny white buds on it.
"It would be spring in Buckkeep by now,"
he said in a low voice, and then added quickly,
"I'm sorry. Pay no attention to me. I'm sorry."
"Are you feeling any better?" I asked him, resolutely thrusting spring flowers and bees and Molly's candles out of my mind.
"A little."
His voice shook, and he took a quick breath.
"I wish we could walk more slowly."
"We'll camp soon," I told him, knowing that we could not slow our pace now. I felt a growing urgency and had developed the notion it came from Verity. I pushed that name, too, from my mind, Even walking down the wide road in daylight, I feared that Regal's eye was only a blink away, and that if I glimpsed it, they would once more hold me under their power. For an instant, I hoped Carrad and Will and Burl were cold and hungry, but then realized I could not safely think of them either.
You were sick like this before,
I observed to the fool, mostly to think of something else.
Yes, in Blue Lake. My lady queen spent the food money on a room that I might be in out of the rain.
He turned his head to stare at me.
Do you think that might have caused it?
Caused what?
Her child to be stillborn.
His voice dwindled off. I tried to think of words.
I don't think it was any one thing, fool.
She simply suffered too many misfortunes while she was carrying the babe.
Burrich should have gone with her and left me. He would have taken better care of her. I wasn't thinking clearly at the time.
Then I'd be dead, I pointed out. Among other things. Fool, there is no sense in trying to play that game with the past. Here is where we are today, and we can only make our moves from here. And in that instant, I suddenly perceived the solution to Kettle's game problem. It was so instantly clear that I wondered how I could not have seen it. Then I knew. Each time I had studied the board, I wondered how it could have got into such a sorry condition. All I had seen were the senseless moves that had preceded mine. But those moves had no longer mattered. Once I held the black stone in my hand, a half-smile crooked my lips. My thumb rubbed the black stone.
"Where are we today?"
the fool echoed, and I felt his mood shadow mine.
"Kedrickin said that you might not truly be ill, that it might be peculiar to your kind."
I was uncomfortable coming even that close to a question regarding this.
"It could be, I suppose. Look."
He drew off his mitten, then reached up and dragged his nails down his cheek. Dry white trails followed them. He rubbed at it, and the skin powdered away beneath his hands. On the back of his hand, the skin was peeling as if it had been blistered. "It's like a sunburn peeling away. Do you think it's the weather you've been in?"
"That, too, is possible. Save that, if it is like last time, I shall itch and peel over every bit of my body, and gain a bit more color in the process. Are my eyes changing?"
I obliged him by meeting his gaze. Familiar as I was with him, it was still not an easy task. Had those colorless orbs darkened a trifle more?
"Perhaps they are a bit darker, no more than ale held up to the light. What will happen to you? Will you continue to have fevers and gain color?"
"Perhaps. I don't know,"
he admitted after a few moments had passed.
"How could you not know?" I demanded. "What were your elders like?"
"Like you, foolish boy. Human. Somewhere back in my bloodline there was a white. In me, as rarely happens, that ancient blood is given form again. But I am no more white than I am human. Did you think that one such as I was common to my people? I have told you, I am an anomaly, even among those who share my mixed lineage. Did you think white prophets were born every generation? We would not be taken so seriously if we were. No. Within my lifetime, I am the only white prophet."
"But could not your teachers, with all those records you said they kept, tell you anything of what to expect?"
He smiled, but bitterness was in his voice.
"My teachers were too certain that they knew what to expect. They planned to pace my learning, to reveal what they thought I should know when they thought I should know it. When my prophecies were different from what they had planned, they were not pleased with me. They tried to interpret my own words for me. There have been other white prophets, you see. But when I tried to make them see that I was the white prophet, they could not accept it. Writing after writing they showed me to try to convince me of my effrontery in insisting on such a thing. But the more I read,
the more my certainty grew. I tried to tell them my time was nearly upon me. All they could counsel me was that I should wait and study more to be certain. We were not on the best terms when I left. I imagine they were quite startled to find I was gone so young from them, even though I had prophesied it for years.
He gave me a strangely apologetic smile.
Perhaps if I had stayed to complete my schooling, we would know better how to save the world.
I felt a sudden sinking in the pit of my stomach. So much had I come to rely on a belief that the fool, at least, knew what we were about.
"How much do you truly know of what is to come?"
He took a deep breath, then sighed it out.
"Only that we do it together, Fitzy Fitz. Only that we do it together."
"I thought you had studied all those writings and prophecies."
"I did. And when I was younger I dreamed many dreams, and even had visions. But it is as I have told you before, nothing is a precise fit. Look, you Fitz. If I showed you wool and a loom and a set of shears, would you look at it and say, 'Oh, that is a coat I will some day wear'? But once you have the coat on, it is easy to look back and say, 'Oh, those things foretold this coat.'"
"What is the good of it, then?" I demanded in disgust.
"The good of it?"
he echoed.
"Ha ha! I have never quite thought of it in those terms before. The good of it."
We walked for a time in silence. I could see what an effort it was for him to keep the pace, and wished vainly there had been a way to keep one of the horses and get it past the slide area.
"Can you read weather sign, Fitz? Or animal tracks?"
"Some, for weather. I am better at animal tracks."
"But in either one, are you always sure you are right?"
"Never. You don't really know until the next day dawns, or you bring the beast to bay."
"So it is with my reading of the future. I never know. Please let us stop, even if only for a bit. I need to get my breath and take a sip of water."
I obliged him, reluctantly. There was a mossy boulder just off the road, and he seated himself there. Not too far from the road were evergreens of a type I did not know. It rested my eyes to look on trees again. I left the road to sit beside him, and was instantly aware of a difference. As subtle as bees humming was the working of the road, but when it suddenly ceased, I felt it. I yawned to pop my ears, and suddenly felt more clear-headed.
"Years ago I had a vision,"
the fool observed. He drank a bit more water, then passed the skin to me.
"I saw a black buck rising from a bed of shining black stone. When first I saw the black walls of Buck Keep rising over the waters, I said to myself, 'Ah, that is what that meant.' Now I see a young bastard whose sigil is a buck, walking on a road wrought from black stone. Maybe that is what the dream signified. I don't know. But my dream was duly recorded, and some day, in years to come, wise men will agree as to what it signified, probably after both you and I are long dead."
I asked a question that had long prickled me. "Kettle says there is a prophecy about my child. The child of the catalyst."
"That there is,"
the fool confirmed calmly. "Then you think Molly and I are doomed to lose Nettle to the throne of the six duchies?"
"Nettle. You know I like her name. Very much I do."
"You did not answer my question, fool."
"Ask me again in 20 years. These things are so much easier when one looks back."
The sideways glance he gave me told me he would say no more on that topic. I tried a new tack. "So you came all that way so that the six duchies would not fall to the red ships?" He gave me an odd look, then grinned as if astonished.
"Is that how you see it? That we do all this to save your six duchies?"
When I nodded, he shook his head.
"Fitz, Fitz, I came to save the world. The six duchies falling to the red ships is but the first pebble in the avalanche."
He took another deep breath.
I know the red ships seem disaster enough to you, but the misery they make to your folk is no more than a pimple on the world's buttocks. Were that all, were it simply one set of barbarians seizing land from another, it would be no more than the ordinary working of the world. No, they are the first stain of poison spreading in a stream. Fitz, do I dare tell you this? If we fail, the spread is fast. Forging takes root as a custom, nay, as an amusement for the high ones. Look at Regal and his King's Justice. He has succumbed to it already. He pleasures his body with drugs and deadens his soul with his savage amusements. Aye, and spreads the disease to those around him until they take no satisfaction in a contest of skill that draws no blood, until games are only amusing if lives are wagered on the outcome. The very coinage of life becomes debased, slavery spreads, for if it is accepted to take a man's life for amusement, then how much wiser to take it for profit?
His voice had grown in strength and passion as he spoke. Now he caught his breath suddenly and leaned forward over his knees. I set a hand on his shoulder, but he only shook his head. After a moment he straightened.
I declare, talking to you is more wearying than hiking. Take me at my word, Fitz. As bad as the red ships are, they are amateurs and experimenters. I have seen visions of what the world becomes in the cycle when they prosper. I vow it shall not be this cycle.
He heaved himself to his feet with a sigh and crooked out his arm. I took it, and we resumed our walking. He had given me much to think about, and I spoke little. I took advantage of the gentling countryside to walk alongside the road rather than upon it. The fool did not complain of the uneven ground. As the road plunged ever deeper into the valley, the day warmed and the foliage increased. By evening, the terrain had mellowed so much that we were able to pitch the tent not only off the road, but quite a distance from the road. Before bedtime, I showed Kettle my solution to her game, and she nodded, as if well pleased. She immediately began to set out a new puzzle. I stopped her. I do not think I will need that tonight. I am looking forward to truly sleeping.
Ayo, then you shouldn't look forward to waking up again.
I looked shocked. She resumed setting out her pieces.
You are one against three, and those three are coterie.
She observed more gently.
And possibly those three are four. If Regal's brothers could skill, he most likely has some ability. With the aid of the others, he could learn to lend his strength to them.
She leaned closer to me and lowered her voice, although the others were all busy with camp chores.
You know it is possible to kill with the skill. Would he wish to do less than that to you?
But if I sleep off the road, I began.
The force of the road is like the wind that blows alike on all. The ill wishes of a coterie are like an arrow that targets only you. Besides, there is no way you can sleep and not worry about the woman and the child, and every time you think of them it is possible the coterie sees them through your eyes. You must crowd them out of your mind.
I bent my head over the game cloth. I awoke the next morning to the pattering of rain on the tent skins. I lay for a time listening to it, grateful that it was not snow, but dreading a day of walking in rain. I sensed the others waking up around me with a keenness I had not had in days. I felt almost as if I had rested. Across the tent, Starling observed sleepily. We walked from winter to spring yesterday. Next to me, the fool shifted, scratched, and muttered,
"Typical minstrel, exaggerate everything."
"I see you are feeling better," Starling retorted.
Night Eyes thrust his head into the tent, a bloody rabbit dangling in his jaws.
"The hunting is better, too."
The fool sat up in his blankets.
"Is he offering to share that?"
My kill is your kill, little brother.
Somehow, it stung to hear him call the fool brother. Especially when you've already eaten two this morning. I asked him sarcastically.
No one forced you to lie in bed all dawn.
I was silent a moment.
I have not been much companion to you lately.
I apologized.
I understand. It is no longer just we two. Now we are pack.
You are right. I told him humbly.
But this evening I intend to hunt with you. The scentless one may come too if he wishes. He could be a good hunter did he try, for his scent could never give him away.
He not only offers to share meat, he invites you to hunt with us this evening. I had expected the fool to decline. Even at Buck he had never shown any inclination toward hunting. Instead, he inclined his head gravely toward Night Eyes and told him,
I would be honored.
We struck camp speedily, and were soon on our way. As before, I walked beside the road rather than upon it, and felt clearer-headed for it. The fool had eaten voraciously at breakfast, and now seemed almost his old self. He walked upon the road, but within hailing distance, and kept up a merry chattering to me all day. Night Eyes ranged ahead and behind, as always, frequently at a gallop. All of us seemed infected with the relief of warmer weather. The light rain soon gave way to a streaky sunlight, and the earth steamed fragrantly. Only my constant ache over Molly's safety, and a nagging fear that at any time Will and his cohorts might attack my mind, kept it from being a lovely day. Kettle had warned me about letting my mind dwell on either problem, lest I attract the coterie's attention. So I carried my fear inside me like a cold black stone, resolutely telling myself there was absolutely nothing I could do. Odd thoughts popped into my head all day. I could not see a flower bud without wondering if Molly would have used it for scent or color in her work. I found myself wondering if Burridge was as good with a wood axe as he was with a battle axe, and if it would be enough to save them. If Regal knew of them, he would send soldiers after them. Could he know of them without knowing exactly where they were?
Stop that!
Kettle reprimanded me sharply, with a light rap of her walking stick. I jolted back to full awareness. The fool glanced over at us curiously.
Stop what?
I demanded.
Thinking those thoughts, you know what I mean. Were you thinking of anything else? I would not have been able to walk up behind you. Find your discipline!
I did, and reluctantly dredged up the game problem from the night before to concentrate on.
That's better.
Kettle told me in quiet approval. What are you doing back here? I asked suddenly. I thought you and Starling were leading the Jeppas.
We've come to a fork in the road, and another pillar. Before we proceed, we want the Queen to see it.
The fool and I hastened ahead, leaving Kettle to go back and tell Ketrigan of the juncture. We found Starling sitting on some ornamental stonework at the side of the road while the Jeppas